As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Before we begin, a content warning. This episode contains discussions of pastoral exclusion, institutional retaliation, spiritual trauma, and the marginalization of LGBTQ plus individuals within faith communities. Some listeners may find these stories distressing, especially those with past experiences of church-based harm or identity-based rejection. If you need support, please check out the show notes or visit spoiledfruitpodcast.com/resources for organizations that offer confidential help. Listener discretion is advised. I want to be clear. This isn't a debate about theology. It's about what happened to pastors who dared to wrestle with a difficult question out loud. How do we love and serve our LGBTQ plus congregants well, without violating our conscience or abandoning our calling? These stories aren't about changing doctrine. They're about how a movement that once prided itself on the radical middle began drawing red lines, and what happened to the leaders who crossed them. Let's begin with Ken Wilson, founding pastor of Vineyard Church of Ann Arbor. He was part of the Vineyard movement for nearly 40 years. He was drawn in during the Wimber era, not because of signs and wonders, but because Vineyard seemed like a refuge for more rigid movements.
It was a decompression. That's important to understand. It was a decompression from my prior experience. And I've noticed that that's the case for a lot of Vineyard pastors. There are a lot of Vineyard pastors who are in like wacko, really, you know, like really super intense environments, whether it was fundamentalism or charismatic movements of the 70s, which were wild and crazy. And so for many people, Vineyard was like a decompression. And it was like a much more laid back, much more relaxed, much more humane, sane, rational than other systems. That was my story too. So
he served as a regional overseer, helped shape national policy, and led a growing church. But over time, a tension began to grow in his spirit, especially when LGBTQ plus people in his congregation asked whether they could ever be fully included. Eventually, he could no longer live with the cognitive dissonance.
And I was like, I can't live with myself. I can't look at myself in the mirror. I know too much now.
So in 2014, Ken wrote what would become a letter to my congregation, a compassionate, deeply theological call to re-examine the Vineyard's approach to LGBTQ plus people. It wasn't a manifesto, it was a pastoral letter. And what came next shocked him.
By that time, still there wasn't a national policy. And you know, when the edict from headquarters came down about our local church situation and requiring that I agree not to ordain any gay people in an active relationship, that if I have any pastors on staff or in such a relationship, I fire them or discipline them, and that I not publicly object to the national policy. That was before there was an actual national policy.
Before publishing his book, Ken says he sought conversation. He met one-on-one with board members. He tried to follow Vineyard process, but no formal dialogue ever took place.
No one would engage me in a serious way. You know, I would tell over the course of a few years, I told different board members where I was headed, and you know, they were like alarmed, and they're like frightened for me, you know. And So there wasn't a lot of back and forth. I was eager for having those kind of conversations.
And then came the warning.
Rich Nathan, who at one point told me he thought it was a second order moral issue, you know, said to me one time, you know, Ken, do you know where you're going? If you keep going in this direction, you know, you're going to be outside the circle, you know.
When Vineyard ultimately cut ties with him, Ken didn't fight. He stepped away to protect the LGBTQ plus people in his congregation who were already wounded. He and co-pastor Emily Swan planted a new church, Blue Ocean. Today, they're celebrating nearly 10 years as a fully inclusive community.
And then the freedom. I hope there's some pastor listening who's thinking of making them transition. But the freedom to be able to just speak and preach and not have to like deal. I had spent, you know, decades, you know, like introducing environmental concern and, you know, science and I did like sermon series on this. So I'm always battling in my mind the conservative objections. Every sermon that I gave, I would have to like, I knew there were a certain number of people who came from an evangelical background or were even fundamentalists or young earth creationists or whatever, listening to Rush Limbaugh. And that wasn't the dominant ethos at all. But, you know, it doesn't take a very, you know, large minority to cause a ruckus in a church. And so I was constantly crafting my sermons. And then it took me like 6 months to just realize I don't have to speak defensively anymore. And I'd see the looks on their faces and that they'd be like, we're with you. And I was a beloved pastor in my church, you know, my old church. But this was a whole different thing. The sense of freedom, the relief, you know, was such a balm in my Gilead, you know, like it was. And the trauma was real.
In Chattanooga, Tennessee, Pastor Melody Winderweedle led a small Vineyard church through seasons of growth, struggle, and transformation. Her journey towards LGBTQ plus inclusion didn't begin with an agenda. It began with people, and it collided head-on with a system more interested in growth metrics than spiritual health.
So as a pastor, every year we'd have to do a census for the Vineyard and tell them how many people we introduced to Jesus and how many baptisms we did that year. And that was the indicator of how healthy our church was. We, as you said before, live in the buckle of the Bible Belt. So everybody who came to our church had already been baptized and already knew about Jesus because of where we live and the culture that we live in. So any metrics around that revealed that our church was not growing or that our church, in my mind, it made it look like our church wasn't healthy. But over the years, I started to see like, no, our church is actually like the healthiest it's ever been, even though we have fewer people, like the numbers don't match the health, but that's sort of the cost of healing.
Over time, Melody began to realize that this obsession with external measures came at a steep cost to honesty and to the people who didn't fit neatly into Vineyard's public image.
So nobody ever asked, is your church healthy? People just ask, how many people are going to your church? Has it grown this year? You know, how's the giving? Those were the questions they asked rather than like, hey, how's the soul of your church? Are people healthy? Are people thriving? Are you making disciples? Are they growing in their depth of their relationship with God? No one ever asked those questions. But we were told that the reason that we want to get these metrics is because we're out here saving souls. We want to tell more people about Jesus. And it's like, if that's true, then what you really need to be asking us is different questions than how many people have accepted Jesus and how many people have we baptized. Because it was zero, even though amazing growth was happening in our community. There's no way to measure that. And so it really did feel, it felt like a business.
As Melody began advocating for LGBTQ plus inclusion in her church, she was met with silence from Vineyard leadership and subtle signals that she was no longer welcome to lead.
I know that there are people who are maybe never going to change their minds about queer inclusion or women in ministry. And that's really okay. Just don't hate people because of it. Like, you know, just don't, like, view everybody as image bearers of God, right? Treat everybody with dignity and respect. If you can't agree with it because of the way that you're viewing the Bible, that's fine. We can have conversations about that. But I'm still an image bearer of God. My queer siblings are still image bearers of God, and they deserve dignity and respect regardless.
When her congregation learned what had happened, they voted unanimously to disaffiliate from Vineyard USA.
I mean, I was able to be very honest with our congregation. We had what we call a family meeting and told them what happened in the meeting, and like unanimously voted to disassociate from the Vineyard at that point.
Pastor J.T. Meyer grew up in the Vineyard. His parents were respected Vineyard leaders. His ministry began in the movement. He was all in. But when he began asking questions about inclusion, accountability, and integrity, he discovered that Vineyard USA didn't have room for those questions, or for people like him. JT wasn't aiming to deconstruct. He loved his church. He believed in the Vineyard's ideals. But when he looked under the hood of the movement, especially around leadership training, accountability, and abuse prevention, what he saw disturbed him.
Even if you don't say, here are the things that we want you to put in your bylaws, like here are the things that, here's how people can report, you know, abuse or whatever. There's not even any training on how to handle that stuff anyways, or how to write bylaws, or how to, like, you know, do any of that stuff, or how to, you know, handle a budget with integrity or any of that stuff. It's just kind of like this, you know, throw you out to the wolves and see if you survive.
JT's story wasn't just about theology. It was about infrastructure, about integrity, and about what happens when a movement prioritizes expansion over formation. He speaks not just for himself, but for the countless pastors left to navigate leadership without support, guardrails, or clarity.
Most Vineyard pastors I know love Jesus, love the kingdom, love people, and I don't think we're adequately set up to pastor a church.
For JT, Vineyard was home, until it wasn't. His departure wasn't dramatic. It was the quiet resignation of someone who realized the system could not, or would not, change. For pastors Tom and A.D. Wasink, inclusion wasn't a trend. It was a conviction forged through tears, arguments, years of prayer, and hundreds of conversations with their congregation. Their story didn't begin with politics. It began with people.
Whether I'm worried about hosting or just giving that perfect gift, creating a delicious holiday for my loved ones is super important to me. From effortless holiday hostings to unforgettable gifts, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. They've always been super convenient in giving me the most high-quality steaks I could ask for, whether for myself or a loved one. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com, and for an extra $35 off, use code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM. Go to omahasteaks.com and use code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
The precursor to what A.D. said was we had some friends from our former church who were queer and were not permitted to live as such. You know, they couldn't live fully expressing themselves in that setting. One of them, whose name in our book is Gusty, she's still a dear friend. We are in contact with her frequently. She just was this amazingly person in any setting, you know, but in our setting, it was the church. And she loved God, had an amazing spiritual practice, interacted well with other people, but she was lesbian. And so it caused her great trouble. And she eventually, not because of actual misbehavior, but was kicked out. And typical stories, she had this kind of period of wandering, wrestling with identity, being alone, and we just watched it happen. And I would always think, my goodness, she has more character and more true Christian practice than I ever will. But look what her life has become. That is not fair.
Tom resisted the change at first, not because of theology, but because of fear. Fear of what it would mean if the church had been wrong.
Big part of my resistance was I just didn't want to do the work. I did not want to do the intellectual work because I knew, like I instantly knew that if we were wrong about this, the whole thing was a house of cards. The whole practice of Christianity that we had come to inhabit, all the years, all the decades, all the thoughts, that if it produced this and if this turned out to be wrong, it wasn't just that we had to, you know, say we had to let some people in who we had formerly barred, you know, because, oh yeah, you didn't, you know, okay, we're changing the age of admission now. You know, it wasn't something like that. It's like the whole edifice would be flawed through and through. And so deconstructionist, like that, yes. And so part of it is I just didn't want to do that. I didn't want to think that hard. I didn't want to have to read. I didn't want to have to remake my practice of Christianity.
A.D. pushed back. She challenged Tom to confront what he saw in the Gospels. And when he did, everything shifted.
It really quickly became a rubric. If I want to know who Jesus would seek out in this setting, I just look for the one that religion would revile. And it was obvious right now who that is, like which group is the most castigated, the most reviled, that the one that makes Christians most apoplectic. And so that was, and so that's what he's talking about, this flip. Because that's where things happen for me, is in the text, in the Jesus stories.
They didn't just change course overnight. They built a roadmap. Conversations, meals, meetings, tears.
We probably had 550 or so regular attenders at that time. We were Vineyard, so you counted. And you counted pregnant women and you counted goldfish, as you mentioned before. But we had around that. And I had done my doctorate in missiology on change. It was leadership, but I was looking at changing from a complementarian organization. So I knew I was familiar with some of the change writers and so forth. But the main thing that I think we understood intuitively is that if we're going to change as a congregation, it's going to require tons and tons of conversations, because all that's happened so far is that Tom and I and a few discreet people have been having years of conversation. And it's happened in our head and we've made changes. So it would be very easy to preach from that place and blow up our church, which I think people have done. And so we did that in every way we could. We did it in leaders' meetings. We did it in members' meetings. We did it inviting ourselves over to people's houses and out to lunch. And we did it along the way. Like, we didn't do it at the point we were ready to make the change in 3 months. We did it as those books that you're talking about were coming out. Matthew Vines had his speech in the church, and I can't think of his name, but you'll know who wrote Torn, had already been written. And now, so there's books, and we're being able to just throw out ideas and possibilities and have conversations. We're able to give teachings that didn't directly speak to it, but maybe began to break down the edifice that Tom's talking about to make a little more fertile soil. But I think the biggest thing, and Tom, you can say what you think, was just ad nauseum conversations. We let people get mad at us. People yelled at us. People cried with us. People wondered if we were heretic.
Yeah, it was a very thoughtful process. And so part of it was what AD is describing. We would actually go through the list of people who were a part of the church and kind of assign ourselves to have conversations with them. And that happened multiple times. There were multiple iterations, because what we didn't understand, AD might have understood a little bit, is even every incremental change in a particular direction is unnerving, you know? So it's not like you just swoop, you know, you come in one fell swoop and institute the new thing.
The Wazings Church left the Vineyard movement, but their community remained intact because it was built on trust, dialogue, and love. Every pastor we've heard from shared the same starting point. They didn't want to leave Vineyard. They wanted to remain loyal to the movement they loved and to the people in their care. All they asked was, can we stay? Can we be affirming and still be Vineyard? The answers they received were strikingly similar.
I think I'm really encouraged, you know, that I think we're going to be able to move forward and maintain connection to Vineyard, which is really my desire, you know. I was just trying to create a little place within an evangelical denomination where it was possible to exist, you know, and not have to implement the exclusionary policies and the discrimination and whatnot.
But later, reflecting on his experience and others who tried to stay, he said,
the thing that I learned experimentally was you can't do it while you're in the denomination. You have to leave the denomination first and then process it. I subjected a lot of our gay congregants to trauma that I regret that they had to experience because that was my lack of wisdom, you know, in thinking that we could stay in the denomination. So all the churches that successfully transitioned after that from the Vineyard setting left Vineyard first, you know.
And so I went to my regional leader and was like, hey, here's the deal. Like, we don't want to leave the Vineyard. Like, we largely love what the Vineyard is doing. There's a lot here, like, that we value. And we're an autonomous church. So can we publicly, like on our website, on our, you know, whatever, say that we're an affirming church and still use the Vineyard name? And we were just flat out told no.
When she asked to be a test case for where the Holy Spirit might be leading,
can we be like a test church for that to see if this is where the Holy Spirit is moving? And I was told that the Holy Spirit isn't moving in that way. So basically like, that's not what the Holy Spirit's doing. So no, if you're going to be affirming, then you need to disassociate from the Vineyard.
The Vineyard doesn't have to change their stance, but can't we at least say that good Christian can disagree about this? And, you know, we've been a big tent movement with everything else. Like everything else we've said, we're going to let the local church decide how they're going to walk this issue out. But can't we do that with this issue too? And it was just, you know, met with a resounding no.
We, and not really our church, but those of us in leadership were interacting with in the Vineyard. And what was clear is the Vineyard was becoming increasingly entrenched in an anti-inclusive stance and was becoming, and they were doing it very differently than they had done other issues in the past, where it was a very heavy-handed, authoritarian, we're just telling you what the answer is on this for Vineyard. And we're telling you how we're going to teach you the right thing to do and say. And so, I mean, that was a part of the process for us too, is this, even how the conversation is happening in Vineyard feels very different than how other conversations on, you know, similar kinds of issues have happened in the past. And so that, you know, in the end is what really forced our hand.
These pastors didn't leave to make a statement. They were pushed out for asking a question. And their stories raise another question, a question Vineyard USA must now answer. If faithful pastors aren't allowed to stay, who is the Vineyard really for? If you followed this series, through stories of pastoral exile, mishandled abuse reports, and systemic silencing, then you've already seen the pattern. When someone in the Vineyard asks hard questions, one of two things happens. They're ignored, or they're removed. That's what happened to pastors who asked how Vineyard handles allegations of abuse. That's what happened to pastors who asked if LGBTQ+ people could be fully included. And the answer, every time, was the same. We don't want to talk about that, or worse, you're no longer one of us. Vineyard USA has long described itself as a, quote, big tent movement. A place where believers of different theological views could coexist. A place where, as John Wimber famously said, everybody gets to play. But can they still claim that? Because when pastors tried to play, by walking with LGBTQ plus people in new and honest ways, they were disqualified. When others raised concerns about abuse and lack of oversight, they were isolated, threatened, or pushed out. It's hard to call yourself a big tent when the moment someone disagrees, you show them the exit. Vineyard also claims to be a relational movement. But when pastors like Ken Wilson, Melody Winderweedle, and the Wazinks asked for a relationship, when they invited national leaders to sit down and talk, no one showed up. What kind of relational culture refuses to even have the conversation? If Vineyard can't make room for disagreement, if Vineyard can't create space for questions, if Vineyard punishes integrity more than it confronts injustice, then maybe it's time to ask, what is the Vineyard now? And more importantly, who is it for? In this episode, we asked a hard question. What is the Vineyard now? And next time, we'll try to answer it by taking a closer look at the national arm of Vineyard USA. Because while individual pastors have been removed, pressured, or silenced, the national arm has quietly been consolidating power, tightening its grip, and bringing churches into line behind closed doors. So who holds that power now? What mechanisms, if any, exist to hold them accountable? Are there checks and balances at the top? Or is the power of Vineyard USA's national leadership now completely unchecked? That's next time on Spoiled Fruit, Faith and Power. I want to take a moment to thank each of the pastors who lent their voices, their stories, and their courage to this episode. Ken Wilson, Melody Winderweedle, Tom and 80 Wazink, and JT Meyer. Your honesty matters, your integrity matters, and your voices will not be silenced here. In the coming days and weeks, I'll be releasing the full uncut interviews with each of these guests, because their experiences deserve to be heard, not just in sound bites, but in full context. If you've been moved by their stories, or if you're part of a community grappling with the same questions, those interviews are for you. Spoiled Fruit, Faith and Power is written, produced, and edited by me, John Williamson. This podcast is a production of John Williamson Productions, LLC. The views expressed by guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this podcast or its producers. Every effort has been made to verify the accuracy of the stories shared in this series. All interviews were conducted with informed consent. Certain segments may include allegations that have not been adjudicated in a court of law. If you or someone you know has experienced spiritual abuse, LGBTQ+ exclusion, or institutional silencing, please visit our website at spoiledfruitpodcast.com/resources for support and advocacy tools.